Hello, I'm Amy. I'm really happy to be here. I'm going to take a little bit different approach because we've got to hear from these wonderful targeted interventions, and now we're going to take a look at a more population-based aspect on what is going on with these naloxone access policies when we look at the entire state. I don't have any relevant financial interest to disclose. And so as we've already heard from a lot of other speakers today, and as most of you in this room are familiar with, we know that mortality from opioid overdose, whether we're speaking about heroin or prescription opioids, has been on the rise for quite some time. Now we know that opioid overdose is the leading cause of injury death in the U.S. For adults over the age of 18, and has been since 2009. We know, again, that opioid overdose can be reversed if naloxone is administered in a timely fashion and there hasn't been stoppage of the heart or other complicating factors. And naloxone, again, as has already been mentioned, has little to no risk for any kind of abuse potential. So several state policies have been implemented at this point to increase how the population can access naloxone, particularly those who are at high risk. But so far, we haven't seen in the literature any type of aggregate analysis of these types of policies. So what we've seen is quite a bit of promising evidence for what happens when we pass a targeted intervention working with one group. And we've seen some really promising results on that front, as we've seen discussed today. But what happens if we're talking about something that's a little more global, a little more generic? And before we get into taking a look at the data, I'd just like to acknowledge that we often mention a person who has perhaps abused or misused prescription opioid medication or is using some sort of illicit opioid such as heroin when we talk about risk of opioid overdose death. But for many of you clinicians in the room, as you're probably very well aware, we need to also think about this potential for overdose risk within our patient population that we're treating for chronic pain conditions. So if you take a look at some of this data that I've compiled from another group of researchers, I just converted it into a graph form. If you look at the line in blue here, you can see in the last few years or so, all we had available is up to 2010, but this line continues to go up over time. And we look at the total visits for people who come in to report non-cancer pain. We see that that is going up over time. Now, simultaneously in red, we see that a greater proportion of those visits are met with a prescription for an opioid medication in order to manage or to treat that chronic pain. So when we're thinking about our population of who's at risk for overdose, we also have to consider that some of our patients who are being managed in a completely appropriate medical way may have these undiagnosed risk factors for respiratory depression that perhaps have gone unnoticed. And that's something that we need to keep in mind here. So getting into this project in particular, what do I mean when I say naloxone access policies? Well, there have been several types of naloxone access policies passed in many states in the U.S. in the last few years, but we're going to focus on three groups of naloxone policies in particular. So first of all, we're going to take a look at policies that are related to prescriber immunity. And we're not distinguishing for the purposes of this analysis a law that says it's civil immunity, criminal immunity, or both or neither, if they just say not liable. So we're going to consider any state that has passed such a law as having a prescriber immunity protection for those who prescribe naloxone. We're also going to look at states that have passed standing order prescriptions or the allowance to do so. So as you've heard from another speaker already, this is what happens when someone who doesn't have innate prescriptive authority in the state has been granted the ability to either prescribe or dispense naloxone without the direct signature or direct approval from the physician for the individual case. So in other words, this is usually a pharmacist or nurse practitioner, or in some cases, like we heard from the previous speaker, another person in the community who has been granted the authority to dispense naloxone after they've received some sort of training or they've entered into a collaborative care agreement with a physician. And then lastly, we're going to take a look at the states that have attempted to expand naloxone access by allowing third-party prescriptions. So in other words, you come into your physician or other person who's approved to dispense naloxone and you say, I think my son or daughter has a problem with prescription opioids, or I think my son or daughter is using heroin, and this is something I want to be prepared for, then the physician can then write the prescription on behalf of that third party, but give it to the person who might be finding the one who has overdosed. So the objective specifically then for this study is, we're going to see if we can determine whether there is a relationship between the states who have adopted and have passed and implemented these naloxone access policies and the opioid overdose mortality thereafter. So in order for us to conduct this study, we had to pull data from a few different sources. And the mortality data, we used publicly available data from the CDC, the WONDER database. In the abstract, you'll notice that we only used up through 2011, but since then, it's been a long time since APHA abstract submission, right? Another year has become available, so this includes the most recent data from that. So we're going to be looking at mortality from 1999 to 2012, and we identified mortality for both prescription opioids as well as illicit opioid substances such as heroin using ICD-10 codes, and this method has been validated in other types of literature. We also are going to be intent agnostic in this analysis. So we're not going to consider whether or not this overdose was a suicide or it was an accident or it was of unknown cause. And then our other data source is going to be directly from the states themselves. What are their published statutes? What does the text say of the published statute? In terms of our dependent variable or how we're actually going to get around to measuring this, we're going to be looking at the counts of opioid overdose deaths. So in our first specification, we're going to look at pharmaceutical opioid deaths in particular. And then secondly, we're going to be looking at heroin. So on the right-hand side of the equation, our independent variables for every state year observation, so we're going to be pulling this out at the state and year level. The first three naloxone access policies that we defined earlier on in the presentation. So this is going to be identified not at the year of passage, but the year of implementation. So if the state passed a law in 2008, but it wasn't effective until 2009, we're going to be saying 2009 and onwards, the state has a law. After those three naloxone access policies per state year, we're also going to be looking at this other potential mitigating factor. Did the state have an operational prescription drug monitoring program at any point during this time that we're looking at? A lot of you in the audience I can see are practicing clinicians. You are probably very familiar with your state's prescription drug monitoring program. 49 out of the 50 states have one now. It is a database collection system that a healthcare practitioner or law enforcement in some states may access in order to determine a patient's controlled substance history. Now, most of the states of the 49 who are using this system, this is a voluntary system, but a handful of states now, including Kentucky, this is a mandatory system if you are a prescriber or in some particular cases, a pharmacist who is dispensing. We're also going to control for a state population, and then we're also going to use unemployment rate within the state in that year as a control for other conditions that are happening in the state which may potentially impact how many people and who exactly is using these types of substances and who's at risk. In terms of our model, we're going to be using a time series since we're looking at trends over time. And this is count data. We're looking at the count of deaths. So we were limited to either Poisson or negative binomial. Our data was pretty over dispersed. As you can tell, there's a lot of difference in state populations. So we had to go with negative binomial. And we're going to be using state and year fixed effects because we know that there is change over time with this trend. Speaking of, let's take a look at it. Now here, there's a lot of stuff going on, but I'd like to draw your attention to that red arrow on the left for the column of median pharmaceutical opioid overdose deaths. So we can see from 1999 to 2012, the latest we had data available at this time, we can see an 8 times increase in deaths in states since 1999. And then when we take a look at heroin, if you follow the red arrow on the right-hand side of the screen, we can see in the same period of time a 5 times increase. Now, just for your information, I didn't want to overcrowd with too many numbers, but if we adjust these figures and we look at a per 100,000 population, we also see the same orders of magnitude increase in median deaths. So let's take a look at some of these results in particular. Let's highlight what's going on. First of all, if we're talking about that naloxone access policy regarding, is the prescriber who prescribed or dispenses naloxone immune from any liability resulting, we see something really interesting. First of all, this isn't associated at all with anything to do with pharmaceutical opioid overdose deaths, or at least not from this analysis. But we do see that there is this 33% decrease in heroin overdose mortality once this law has come into place. Now, I converted these results into incidence rate ratios just so the interpretation would be a little bit more intuitive. Then if we take a look at the standing order law, whether or not the state allowed other people besides the prescriber to prescribe or dispense naloxone, we see again a very similar story. So not much impact or any significant impact on pharmaceuticals. But if we looked at heroin, we saw this decrease. So this 51% decrease after the passage of the law, which is a pretty astounding number. So states then that adopted this third-party prescribing. In other words, you could prescribe on behalf of someone else who was at risk. We see, again, almost the reverse. We don't really see anything interesting happening on the heroin side, but when we look at pharmaceuticals, there is a significant effect, about a 31% decrease. And then in states that had these prescription drug monitoring programs in place, we didn't see anything in pharmaceutical opioids, but interestingly enough, for heroin, we did see this 1.26 times increase in mortality after the policy was implemented. Okay, now if any of you in the audience are economists or you do a lot of policy research, this is something that is driving you crazy right now. I don't like your model. Something could possibly be wrong here, right? Because we don't know if the states who have passed and implemented these policies are doing so out of a spirit of prevention, we want to prevent mortality, or if they have passed these policies as a reaction to an already perceived problem. So which direction is this relationship moving? This is a problem for analysis for us. We have to be able to determine this is where we can draw the line, and here's where we can see the rate change. So as a start to address this problem, this isn't completely solve it, but first of all, we're going to adjust the model by lagging our dependent variable, and we're going to show you those results right now. We also have this other problem of what happens to all the factors that haven't been accounted for here. In particular, the state passed the policy, but perhaps the people who are most affected by the policy were completely unaware, which is a discussion we're going to have in a little bit after you see the next round of results. But we are exploring this in follow-up studies. So here's what happens when we made these first round of adjustments. In terms of prescriber immunity, we see the same significant impact, but the effect has been mitigated a little bit. It's just a little bit less. Same story with standing order. Again, heroin overdose mortality seems to be associated with a decrease after the standing order naloxone access policy has passed. But again, the effect is a little bit less after these adjustments. Now, here is the one that is the most standout of all. Now, we didn't have any significant impact in our unadjusted results for heroin overdose, and we still don't hear. But our pharmaceutical opioid overdose appeared to have some relationship. There was a relationship with third-party prescribing laws, and here that relationship is no more, that has been dissolved. But our relationship with heroin overdose mortality as a result of having an operational monitoring program is sustained and somewhat ameliorated, but a 1.18 times association with the passage of this policy is not something that we can ignore. So overall, let's just do a quick summary. We see that prescriber immunity and standing order laws in regards to naloxone have been associated with a decrease in heroin overdose mortality. However, the third-party prescribing laws, we didn't see any after adjustment a relationship with either heroin or pharmaceutical opioid overdose mortality. We do have some more limitations to consider, though. Thank you. In this analysis. First of all, we do not have the ability with this particular data set to capture non-fatal overdoses. We're only looking at those that resulted in death. And second of all, we have not been controlling for other exogenous events, which I mentioned just a little bit earlier. But for example, states with high concentrations of particular problem areas often pass policies such as needle exchanges, funding for treatment programs or better accessibility to facility beds, changes in the drug court system, new treatment product availability, for example, the new widespread adoption of intranasal form of naloxone as opposed to the traditional needle administration. None of that has been controlled for. And I would also argue that perhaps most importantly, we haven't done anything yet at this point to look at policy enforcement. Now, enforcement is the language they use in the policy world, but I would argue a more appropriate word here would be policy penetration. Policy penetration. The reason for this is, after speaking with some physicians and pharmacists who are most affected in Kentucky, the state where I'm from, with some of these naloxone access policies, their response is, well, we got a memo from the board, and I think we got something in the newsletter from AMA about a change in the law, but we don't really know how that affects me and my primary care practice. This isn't something that changed how I do things. We also heard quite a bit of feedback from pharmacists in particular who would dispense naloxone in their pharmacies that this isn't the service I want to offer my community pharmacist. This may not be attracting the clientele that I necessarily want to have in my pharmacy, which was a little surprising, but has then prompted this next round of research, which I hope to speak with you all about next year, into just because the policy has been passed, how do we clarify and suggest what is the prescriber and the pharmacist's role in the policy after it has been enacted? So moving forward, we need to repeat this analysis with more contemporary data, mostly on the fact that most of the states that have adopted naloxone access policies discussed here did so within the last 3 years. So as of this summer, 15 states now have one of the naloxone policies we talked about today on their books, and by the end of the next round of legislative sessions, it's expected that about 5 more states will have adopted one of these policies soon. So this is a data analysis that needs to be repeated. I'd like to thank you all for listening to me today, and I also want to acknowledge my co-author, Dr. Amanda Fallon, a professor at University of Kentucky, who's in the audience as well. If you have any additional questions and comments that aren't answered in the session, please feel free to email either one of us. Thank you.